Hello, and welcome to The Turbulent World, with me, James M. Dorsey, as your host. Iranians vote with their feet. Earlier this month, turnout for parliamentary elections and the 88-member assembly of experts that appoints Iran's supreme leader was at 41%, an all-time low. In 2022 and 2023, Iran was racked by mass protests, sparked by the death of 22-year-old Iranian Kurd Mahsa Amini while in the morality police's custody. Mrs. Amini was detained for allegedly violating Iran's strict rules requiring women to cover their hair with a hijab or hair headscarf. Many hoped the demonstrations, like multiple earlier protests, signaled the beginning of the end of Iran's clerical regime that came to power in the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The revolt overthrew the Shah, the first toppling in the last 40-plus years of an icon of U.S. influence in the Middle East. Hardliners in the United States and elsewhere have called for supporting civil society opposition. Others advocate breaking Iran apart by supporting ethnic and religious minorities in the country. A historian and political scientist at South Carolina's Clemson University, Arash Azizi, argues that Iran may be on the cusp of change. It's just that the change may come from within the regime rather than from the street. The change is likely to involve a polishing of the sharp edges of the Islamic Republic rather than a transition to democracy. Even so, Arash, the author of two books, a biography of Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Iran's notorious Quds Force, who was killed in 2020 in an American drone strike, and a just-published volume on the recent women's protest movement, argued in the New York Times that Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei's inner circle is populated by technocrats and pragmatists rather than ideologues and revolutionaries who want to perpetuate the status quo. Few will challenge the notion that the eventual passing of the baton by 84-year-old Mr. Khamenei, who is believed to be in poor health, embodies the potential of change, even if the recent Assembly of Experts election was stacked against reformers who were banned from being candidates. Counterintuitively, Arash sees a ray of hope in the eventual transition to a new supreme leader. Reason enough to welcome Arash to the show. Arash, it's a pleasure to host you today.
Thank you, James. It's great to be with you.
Let's kick off with you giving us a bit of your intellectual biography and your engagement with Iran. Allow me to note that links to Arash's books will be at the bottom of the transcript of this podcast, which you will be able to find on my Substack newsletter early next week. Arash, the ether is yours.
Thank you. My name is Arash. As I said, I'm from Iran. And, you know, when it comes to intellectual biography, especially when it comes to Iran's struggle for democracy, it's really sort of inseparable from my life. I was born in Tehran in 1988. It's the country I grew up in. And I had the privilege of, and I really do see it as a privilege of growing up in one of the most fascinating periods in Iranian history. In the late 90s, when I was 9 years old, Iran elected a reformist president, Mohammad Khatami. And, you know, it's not so much just about him or internal politics of the Islamic Republic, but this election really opened a new era in Iranian history where millions of people were seeking change. Millions of people really had beliefs that Iran could be democratized, that it could change very quickly. It was a time of artistic and cultural and, you know, journalistic excellence. There were tons of newspapers everywhere in the society. Everyone sort of spoke about possibilities of change. So it's really exciting time to grow up in. And, you know, I was and I am, I sort of, from early on, I identified as a Marxist and I still see myself that way. I was always on the left side of things. But what definitely hasn't changed is me being part of this, you know, part of this Iranian quest, seeing myself as part of this Iranian quest to to change things and to bring a freer and more democratic and more just Iran. Now, I was a journalist for many years. I was a TV anchor. I then turned to academia, got a PhD in history and Middle Eastern studies from NYU. But these are really all details. The broader picture remains the same, as I said, the broader reference, which is, I'm still really that Iranian citizen trying to imagine a different Iran and hopefully bring about a different Iran as, part of a different world.
And yet you left Iran.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I've left Iran in, the last time I left Iran was 2008, actually. So I haven't been back, like many of the Iranians. I unfortunately haven't been back to Iran for that many years, for close to two decades now. It's funny, when I left in 2008, I couldn't have imagined that I won't be able to go back. I mean, I really didn't imagine that at all. In 2009, we had a grand movement called the Green Movement that started from contesting the presidential election, basically a contestation over the results, but really morphed into a grand anti-regime movement. And really, a lot of us thought this is it, the regime will be gone. I remember I lived in Canada at the time, and I was renting a place, and I was told this, landlord that, I can't sign for another year because the regime will be overthrown before the year is over and I have to go back. So this is really kind of the perhaps naivete that you have also at the, I was 20 years old or something. I left Iran. I lived in many other countries. I lived in Malaysia. I lived in Britain, Germany, Canada, and now the United States.
And you seem to come to the conclusion that it won't be popular revolts that provoke change in Iran. Tell us why you think change will come from the top rather than the bottom, and what that change may look like.
Yeah, it's a very tough reality to sort of admit, if you will. And that sort of, I wrote this piece for the New York Times that you referred to, where I'm talking about this, but also in the epilogue to my book. And this is a book that I wrote really with all my heart. It's called What Iranians Want, Women Like Freedom. When I say with all my heart, because this is a book that on every page of it, I wrote of people that I really consider my heroes. These are my, fellow Iranians, trade unionists, environmental activists, feminist activists. These are people who really, this era that I spoke about from late 90s to now, they waged a heroic struggle over decades against the Islamic Republic. They embody all the wonderful ideas that the regime doesn't, and none of its really different political and military wings do. This book is really, I wrote them as a testament. And the reason I wrote it is that I wanted Iran to not be reduced to what you really have in the headlines, of whether it's a nuclear program or all the soldiers or the Ayatollah. And I wanted to see that there is a different Iran. And much of the work that I do, in fact, is an attempt to ensure that there is a different Iran. However, even in the epilogue of this book, when I'm trying to sort of predict the future of Iran, if you will, I have to admit, one has to be honest, that it's not clear that it's the, it's these movements that will be the only ones who are calling the shot. I mean, it's clear that won't be the case, right? And one has to be brutally honest. Now, the reality is that the grand movements for civil liberties, for democracy that I talked about, have had a basic failure in the last couple of decades. And that has been a failure to translate their power and their demands into a political channel. This is a very important thing, and I think it's an important ailment, basically. I think we have a political deficit around the world. I often, when in this conversation, I often point to the new book by Vincent Bevins, about the missing decade of 2010s. This is a writer, a journalist who goes and looks at all the different mass movements in 2010s to show, some of the reasons that they failed. And when you look at it, whether it's the Arab Spring, or a movement in Brazil, or a lot of other places, even in Ukraine in some sense, actually, what becomes clear is that there is a you know, there is a failure to translate this mass movement into a political channel, the political proper political channel, especially because there is a lack of now a tradition of political parties, organized political forces that were very powerful in the 20th century. And somehow by the end of the 20th century, we convinced ourselves, and I said, we, you know, on the left and on the right, it's interesting, this sort of convergence on the left in the name of autonomism or horizontalism, and on the right and the sort of and the language of end of ideology and all that. We convinced ourselves that this was sort of all the bad 20th century stuff, and we don't need it anymore. All we need now are hashtags and, spontaneous people coming together. But unfortunately, you don't get political change like that. So unfortunately, in Iran, for a variety of reasons, these movements that I am very proud to be a part of have failed politically to cohere into a political alternative. And we have to be honest, right? Everyone loves to, whenever you lose in politics, everyone loves to say you scored a moral victory. Unfortunately, moral victories don't change history. They don't change people's lives. In politics, it's about winning. It's about being able to dislodge the dictators that are in power. And, you know, there is no clear path for this sort of freedom movements in Iran to do so. So I'd like to...
If I can interject, I think, you know, just to sharpen what you're saying, because I agree with you, I think the problem that you see with popular revolts, and you see that going back to 1986 and with people power in the Philippines, and certainly with the popular revolts in 2011, it's that there are two tensions. One is translating street action into backroom bartering and politics. And it's always the question, at what point do you surrender the street? Because once you've surrendered the street, you can't retake it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a fascinating way of looking at it. It's interesting that you brought up Philippines. You know, I don't know enough about it, but I kind of, you look at it actually as a positive example to some ways, because at least in Philippines, they were able to, you know, when I look at countries that have gone through some sort of a democratic transition, I mean, I look at Philippines as one, and that one in which an authoritarian system was replaced by a very imperfect democracy, but at any rate, it is a democracy. People are electing, you know, their leader in the poll, which would be a dream for Iranians, frankly, if we got to a place where we had, you know, we had anything like that. But I'm fascinated by the way you put it, because that's precisely the point, though. Yes, you're right that when you give up the street to the back room, you cannot take it back, but also you cannot keep the street forever, right? So Absolutely. If you're in politics, right, you either cash it in at some time or it dissipates, because people, human beings are, you know, one of the craziest things that I've heard, you know, on the left from friends and all, that yes, if you are in your early 20s and you love going to demonstrations, this is a big part of your life, you come under the illusion that wouldn't this be great if this was life, basically, right? That you know, all the time we did was this. But even leftists themselves will say this, usually they get to an age where they get a job and they get married, whatever, and they're not interested in doing this every day. Certainly most people, you know, they're not trying to be political actors every day. They're trying to live their lives, right? If they can help it, perhaps they like to even not think about politics as much. And we can be critical of that, but any means that, you know, you have to work with new ones that you have. So I think the key thing is to know whether it's for popular revolts or any sort of political action, it's key thing to know what is your strategy and how you can sort of channel it. But if I go back to your original question.
Yeah, let me just interject here, because I think this is a fascinating discussion, but I do want you to come back to my question.
Yeah, and of course.
I co-authored a book several years ago, which compared political transition in the Philippines, political transition in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. And what we concluded was that in the case of the Philippines, in the case of Indonesia, and in fact, also in the case of Myanmar, prior to the military coup, what worked was that there were three players in this. There was a strong civil society, But there also was a faction of the military that saw an advantage or an interest in supporting change. And so that's what you really had in Southeast Asia. And that's what, in a lot of ways, you lacked in the Middle East.
Well, that's, if there was ever a segue, that's it. Yeah, that's really fascinating, because that's exactly sort of what I'm trying to explore in regards to Iran.
But let's go back to Iran, indeed.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's exactly this question, right? To go back to your original question, which relates to this point about sort of the comparison between Southeast Asia and the Middle East. The way I would put it, by the way, right? The way, in New York Times, it's an op-ed, so I would extend to it the point a little too much, right? The way I would put it is not so much that the change will come from the top, not the bottom, although that, there is also truth to that. But let me put it here, if I may. I basically think that, a variety of, let's call them civic movement, this pro-democracy movement, these people that I wrote this book about, right? These people who want a different Iran and who are idealists. I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean, there are those who have ideals, right? They want a different Iran. They have substantive ideas about a gender justice, about social justice. They'll continue to be a big part of future of Iran, right? And that's sort of the camp that I consider myself a part of. In fact, whatever change happens at the top, I even do say there, right? Whatever change happens at the top, they're not going to stop fighting. They're going to stop, they're going to continue the struggles, right? But the thing is, the Islamic Republic is not just that it falls short of these more substantive ideas of justice, but that in a sort of a really moment of crisis in which it's suffering from acute incompetency, an acute sort of legitimacy crisis, it follows policies that seem to be in favor of no one, really. It's funny, we often like to compare the late Islamic Republic, as we call it, a bit hopefully, with the late Soviet Union, saying that, there was an ideological crisis, there was an economic crisis. But when you look at late Soviet Union, it's doing rather great compared to Islamic Republic. At the end of the day, whatever you say about a state socialism, it had some coherence. It was followed around the world. There were millions of people around the world who sort of saw some hope in it. But the Islamic Republic, it's really hard to see anyone really believing in it as an alternative model. So to make the story short, what I'm arguing is that Khamenei is going to be 85 next month. He's going to die and pass away at some point. And it's not just that his passing is important, but at the moment, he is really the only thing that holds together this highly disparate system together of people who have sharp disagreements with each other, they're vying for power, and no one really believes in the ideals of this revolution anymore, the ideas of 1979 revolution. It hasn't been able to create even a coherent form of alternative. Iran is not more religious. Iran is ever more capitalistic. You cannot look at this and say, this is a sort of Islamic model of life. If you look at all these foreign supporters of the Islamic Republic who come to Iran, it's very rare for them to praise the domestic regime. The most they can do is say, Iran is great because it's supporting anti-Israel forces in the region, right? So my argument is that elements in the leadership of the Islamic Republic today and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, this militia that undergirds much of the power, that they are the ones who are most likely to come on top after the death of Khamenei. I think popular movements will make their attempt, but frankly, I think it's most likely that the IRGC, these other established forces, will come on top, at least initially, and that I do believe that they will make some fundamental changes in Iran, because they want to make the country less of a basket case, frankly, less of a crisis mode. So that's sort of the root of this prediction or prognosis that I have for the immediate future of Iran.
I mean, this goes straight to my next question. You've described the technocrats among those people as military people. In other words, if I read this correctly, and I think that's what you're saying, the post-Khamenei era would involve a transition to a greater role for the IRGC, or the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, which would drive the change, whereas the pragmatists that you also sort of point out within the regime, and particularly within Khamenei's inner circle, are largely former diplomats. Is that correct?
Actually, so the first part is definitely correct. Is that so? There is a yes. I believe that this militia IRGC is likely to have the upper hand in the post-Khamenei period. Now, it's a bit complicated because IRGC itself is not a united force. It has so many disparate groups, but people with different stakes in it. It's also not just a military group, effectively, because, yes, it's a militia primarily, but it's also a massive economic behemoth. So, you know, I think Iran, I imagine sort of Iran looking more like a Pakistan or Algeria in sort of a place where a military caste, if you will have the important role. Now, the diplomats that you mentioned are, so to be clear, when I say pragmatists, I also actually do mean some of these military leaders. In fact, that they're pragmatists, that they, you know, they care about lining up their own pocket, and they care about economic growth, and they don't want Iran to be sanctioned and isolated and hated by everyone inside and outside Iran. So that's what is going to drive some sort of a pragmatic politics on their part. But the diplomats that you mentioned are one of the fascinating things for me has been looking at a variety of diplomats, Iranian diplomats of the Islamic Republic, who are basically showing a lot of discontent with Khamenei. This is because this is a very sort of delicate point, because, you know, Islamic Republic was founded in 1979, but the Iranian diplomacy, right? If you're a diplomat of Iran, you didn't just become an apparatchik of the regime immediately necessarily, and you weren't just following this ideological course. Iranians, very sort of interesting. Iranians, as you can see from me and others, now we have a very strong sense of our nation, and I'm sure you've had this experience of seeing it without Iranians, right? Doesn't matter whether you are a, you know, sort of dissident in Europe or you're someone in Iran, you have a strong sense of nation. So the Iranian diplomats wanted to follow sort of a traditional sense of Iranian national interest. And if you see, even during the Islamic Republic, for example, let's say in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, I mean, Iran has often played a role that you can't say ideological or in support of Islamist revolutionary ideas. It's sort of traditional Iranian foreign policy, sort of national interest role. Whereas they see that has dissipated on the Khamenei, especially in the last years. They're not happy that Iran is a supporter of Hamas, that it is, you know, but it's banking, you know, not just that it's supporting Hamas, but it's banking so much on it that it sort of, there's the part that is helping Russia against Ukraine, that they're very unhappy about that. But this also shows you, yeah, there are sections of the establishment who are unhappy about the results of Khamenei. And that's why I sort of mentioned the diplomats. Now, yes, some of them, many of them in the future of Iran can form a very different group than, let's say, people coming out of IRGC, right? Jawad Zarif, the former foreign minister, eternally, you think, I mean, if he did want to have political ambitions, he always says he doesn't, he would never run for anything. But if he was going to have political ambitions, I think, you know, frankly, he probably would be good at it. You know, he definitely has committed some, obviously, a lot of us don't buy much from him. But, you know, anyways, he definitely can come with some. So, a variety of former officials of the regime, whether it's diplomats, whether it's those who are in more economic positions or in militias, can have some sort of a future in the post-Khamenei era as they vie for power. But, you know, those who hold the guns and power currently are the IRGC folks. So it's likely that they'll be the ones sort of running the game for a while. They're the ones who are organized.
What's also interesting is that the people you're talking about are already now, or for some time, been publicly expressing their dissent and their criticism. So it's not just an assumption that what these people say. They're actually willing to go out and say it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, it's very interesting in a regime like Iran, because you know, there's actually a lot of discontent that being spoken about. So I'm not even talking about, you know, the circle of dissent keeps getting wider in a way. The circle of permitted, so like the opposition, people like me who oppose the Islamic Republic, obviously we are nowhere near power. There's no way we can even publish newspapers and all that. But even inside Iran, then those who are, let's say, reformists, sort of loyal opposition critiques of the Islamic Republic, they've been effectively booted out of parliament. You know, they don't have a public political life. But inside, you know, inside the conservative and ultra-conservative camp, no matter how much you exclude, right, there's still a lot of fight about, you know, against the corruption of this or that individuals or different policies. I mean, when things are so bad, you have to blame someone, right? The thing is, Iran has declining economy, which I think is the key of everything, by the way, right? None of the discussions we had really would have meant much, if I'm honest with you, if Iran was doing economically very well. That's just, right. People don't like to admit that. You know, I would ask my students, you know, would you prefer to live in a poor country or an undemocratic country? And a lot of them always say, oh, no, I would live poor but free. But the reality is, right, when the economy is bad, it really, that's sort of fundamental change. And you really realize how bad the Iran economy is, right? Like the GDP per capita of Iran now, in real terms, is significantly less than, and, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but significantly less than 10 years ago. By some estimates, I think it's like a third of 10 years ago, right? This is crazy, right? Imagine your living standards falling to a third by in just 10 years. So you have to blame someone. So yes, there is tons of people who are always attacking each other and who are always expressing criticisms. As I said, the foreign policy in support of various support of Hamas or support of Russia and Ukraine is being critiqued by, you know, not by people like me, but by leading former diplomats or sort of establishment figures, public intellectuals, those types inside Iran. And this is after, you know, prisons are full of thousands of people who are there because they critique it, but there's still people are still making their criticisms. And I think, you know, the other thing I'll tell you is that, look, just if you get outside of immediate sort of political, you know, harmony this, harmony that, there is a, if you're honest and sober, you know, if you're someone in Iran who really cares about Iran, Iranians care about their country usually. They like to sort of have this state of Iran discussions often, right? It's very clear to everybody that we are in some sort of a very deep crisis. I think, and many others agree with me, that this is the worst Iran has been since easily 100 years ago. You know, so naturally, when you're in conditions like this, people are voicing critique publicly. It's just that usually, in order to not get into trouble, they, you know, this regimes like this afford this. You can critique everything and be like, oh, of course, the supreme leader would agree with me. You know, he doesn't want this, right? Because that's how you save yourself. Khamenei himself also, you know, this is one rule of dictators. You know, Mao Zedong also did the same thing, I guess. You know, you control everything, and yet you always act as an opposition leader, right? So Khamenei, in this sort of this Maoist moment, if you will, he's always like waging a revolution against the regime, like saying we need to rejuvenate things and things are not being done well, even though he's really micromanaging even the smallest decisions.
Presumably, the notion of change will also depend on who the next supreme leader will be. Among those touted as potential successors, are there those that would be more supportive than others?
So my line on this is that the next supreme leader is most likely going to be a very weak figure who won't wield much power. That's sort of my two cents or my guess. This is also a state of the art for the last few years. You know, if you have Iranian analysts getting together after a couple of drinks or whatever, everyone likes to predict, you know, who will succeed Khamenei, right? So it's my line here is that it basically, it's going to be a weak figure or perhaps a leadership council. It would need to require constitutional change for that to happen. But in the first constitution of the Islamic Republic, there was a possibility of a leadership council, and then this was gotten rid of in the current version, but they can change it again. Let me tell you that, you know, supreme leader is a very strange position, right? Political scientist Sadri, you know, called the Islamic Republic's constitution the platypus of sort of humanity's constitutional development, because it's a very strange position. its closest analog is Philosopher King in Plato's Republic, right? It's this idea that this wise man, you know, can rule over everything. But in effect, of course, it becomes a sort of a rather dreary dictator. So look, the reality is there's no one, there's no cleric that has the charisma or political expertise or, you know, kind of figure who could replace Khamenei as a convincing supreme leader. All the major candidates died, right? If there was a Rafsanjani, there was Shahrudi, I mean, they basically died, or Khamenei politically sidelined them in one way or the other. So the most likely thing, in my opinion, is that it would be a very weak leader and others will run the show until eventually they might even get rid of the position, basically. But I think Khamenei will be the last real supreme leader of the Islamic Republic. I should tell you that the hottest rumor for some years now, and especially in recent couple of years, is the possible candidacy of Khamenei's son, Mojtaba Khamenei. And I personally don't buy it. I don't think they'll be stupid enough to try to go with that. I think, I mean, put yourself in place of all these IRGC leaders, all this sort of variety of people who are of power in the Islamic Republic. Do you really want to, after all these years of answering Khamenei, do you really want to answer his son, who has no qualifications you can really speak of? Sure, he's like a relatively, you know, he's sort of a relatively informed cleric, basically. They've tried to up his station. He's teaching in the Rome Seminary and all that. But I don't think they'll go with it. I don't think they'll accept it. And also, it's like the irony is a little, it's something for Hosni Mubarak to put his son in his power. But for a revolution that is all about, you know, Islam and justice and blah, blah, to then just turn out into a new monarchy with Khamenei as the ruling family. It's a little too much on the nose, I think. So I don't think people would pull it.
And to be fair to Mojtaba, he has emphatically denied that he has any ambition to succeed his father. But coming back to what change may look like, it strikes me that we've seen hints of change, at least in terms of foreign policy, in recent months. For example, at the Islamic and Arab Emergency Summit in Riyadh last November, Iran adopted a hardline position in the preparatory talks, but then signed off on a final statement that endorsed a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Also, Iran has not categorically rejected a potential Saudi recognition of Israel, but said that a Saudi-Israeli alliance against Iran would be a red line.
Yeah, so, you know, the Iranian foreign policy establishment still does have, you know, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs still does try to use relatively sort of very relatively pragmatic language at times. The first thing we should remember is that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs does not run Iran's foreign affairs, right? None of the major diplomats of Iran in the region are in any shape or form answerable to the foreign minister. You don't need to take my word for it. Prime Minister Zarif has said this repeatedly. He just repeated it a couple of weeks ago in an interview. Others have said it. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs is not really the one running the show, and that's part of the problem. By the way, this is symptomatic of Khamenei's rule, right? One of the things Khamenei has done is that he's built a parallel state, effectively, which runs things. He's built a parallel parliament. Even though the parliament is super sort of dominated by ultra-conservatives, effectively now he has what he calls High Council. So High Council for Cyberspace, High Council for Economy, and they are the ones who are passing laws. So, but I think what that shows you, things that you mentioned, like they wouldn't object necessarily to a resolution that would implicitly or explicitly endorse a two-state solution, or what they say about potential Saudi-Israel recognition. It shows that there are definitely elements in the Iranian establishment that are happy to be more pragmatic about it. The reality of all of this is, we can talk about a specific issue, but if I just give a broad picture, the reality of it is, you know, Iran, again, I think it's very important to remember that Iran is an ancient civilization. I know everyone is sort of tired of hearing this, of Iranians saying it, but it really does matter because Iranians see themselves that way, right? We were a founding member of the League of Nations, the only Muslim country with a founding member of the League of Nations. We were, in fact, in the Council of the League of Nations. We were a founding member of the United Nations. So when Iranians whether on a popular level or on policymaking level at some point, think of their country, they're often thinking of Iran, right? They're not thinking of first the Palestinian cause or the first the Israelis. So they're thinking of Iran. They're Iran-centered in this way. And on that basis, it's not that strange that, you know, it doesn't, from the Iranian national interest, frankly, it doesn't make sense for us to be very one-sided in any conflict in the region. It doesn't make sense for us to be very one-sided, either pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. And same with Azerbaijan, Armenia, as I said, it doesn't make sense for Iran to, you know, for example, to necessarily side with Azerbaijan just because it's Shia or Muslim. And that's why, in many ways, it has backed the Armenia. Unfortunately, this ended only sort of recently. Anyway, not to get into Caucasus, that's its own thing. But my point is not this Iran-centeredness and the priority of Iranian national interest means that there are many who think Iran should play a much more constructive role in this region, and that, you know, and as a part of the reality here is today, no Arab state, not one, fights against Israel, doesn't fire a single bullet against Israel. You know, when I teach Arab-Israeli conflict, I usually tell my students that effectively we know Arab-Israeli conflict mostly ends by 1979. It's a Palestinian-Israeli conflict that continues, but Arab states are not fighting Israel after 1979. Ironically, Iran is born in 1979, and sort of it carries on the mantle. And it just doesn't make sense for us. Basically, why is it that Iran, which is not an Arab state, which doesn't have any reason to want to destroy Israel from the perspective of its national interest, why should it be the only state that puts itself in danger and that it's the only one firing shots at Israel against the wishes of the Palestinian leadership, more importantly, and the leadership of every other Arab state. So I think a lot of Iranians, both on the popular level, as I said, and but even in foreign policy decision-making levels, think, you know, we can't be, and they say this publicly again, it's not just me saying it, that we can't be more Catholic than the Pope, right? We, you know, we cannot, we have to lead, we have to, you know, cannot be more Arab than Arabs, basically, than Arab cause, and has always long been an Arab cause. And Iran can play an auxiliary role. It can play a role of its own sort of national interest, but it doesn't make sense for it to act like it's a frontline state who's put all its eggs on the basket of this goal of illusion of wanting to destroy Israel. And its leadership repeatedly says, and as all these militias that it supports say. Whereas in effect, you know, when you look at alternatives, you know, Erdogan is pretty anti-Israel. He doesn't even cut diplomatic relations with Israel, right? And none of the Turkish Islamists, it's very interesting, Turkey Islamists have been in power since 2003. They've never, in the worst moment, when Israel killed, you know, almost a dozen Turkish peace activists, they still didn't, they suspected, but they didn't entirely cut diplomatic relations with Israel, not to mention trade ties. And, you know, we can bring sort of other examples. So this is to say that many in Iran see that, you know, Iran should have its own policy and it should prioritize itself, and it should not lend, you cannot lend the foreign policy of a country of 80-some million to some ideological goal somewhere. You should prioritize the well-being of your own citizens and peace in the region. And, you know, I think that's very likely that this is the sort of direction of change that you will see in the future of Iran after Khamenei.
Before we come back to the issue of change, it's one thing just to add to what you said about Iranian identity. It is, of course, a fact that Iran is only one of three Middle Eastern states, with a, maybe Israel, four, with a very deep-seated sense of identity, and certainly Israel accepted here with a history of empire alongside Turkey and Oman, which really says something about, you know, or reemphasizes what you were saying about Iranian identity. I want to just for a moment dwell on the Palestinian issue. And, you know, it strikes me that what support for the Palestinians, or what Iranians feel, or this regime feels support should be for the Palestinians, helps the regime basically maintain a facade, a revolutionary facade, even if the revolutionary zeal and the revolution itself has long vanished. Would you think that would be an accurate analysis?
I think yes, in many ways, yes. The way I put it is, and when you think about Islamic Republic, like, put yourself in the place of Khamenei. If you, Khamenei is a genuine revolutionary. He's been a revolutionary all his life, right? Since his 20s, he spent many years to jail and internal exile, and you know, he fought for this revolution. He led it, he was among its founders of the Islamic Republic, and then he's led it since 1989. What achievements do you have? You have no real achievement to speak of in terms of Islamic Republic has not created much of a better life in Iran. His achievement is that Islamic Republic has endured. You can say that, but it's not in a good shape. But one thing you can say is that, yes, it had built a multinational army, an impressive multinational army that does fight against Israel, right? Hezbollah in Lebanon, Houthis in Yemen, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a variety of Iraqi militias. These are all the ones, as I said, not a single Arab state fires a bullet against Israel, but all of these groups are. This is, it's not just a facade. The reality is that this project, does have some reality. There is this, the axis of resistance exists after all, and it's funded and headed by the Islamic Republic. And it's something to be proud of if you are into that sort of thing, right? After all, there were people in the streets of London who were shouting in support of Houthis, unfortunately. So the point is, you can look at this and be a part of it. The problem with it, though, is that, as I said, it doesn't have much support inside Iran, because it's just hard to convert an entire population with a strong sense of national identity to this particular, Islamist, anti-Zionist sort of line. It's very hard for them to buy into this. It's hard for most people to buy into any ideology, right, for an entirety of a nation. But in this case, they see it as diametrically opposed. It's not clear how the axis of resistance is serving Iranian interests. It looks like for Iran, it has brought economic isolation, international isolation, declining its standards of living, we being hated on around the world, having to live under the sanctions, and without advancing any of our national interests. So there is not much support for it inside Iran. So I hope that it's clear what I mean. So it's not a facade in the terms that, it's a general revolutionary project. And yes, if you are a member of Hezbollah in Lebanon, you might really be happy that you're part of this act. Although what I should add to this is that not only it hasn't brought a good life for Iranians, it also hasn't brought a good life for anybody else, right? I mean, look at all these countries that I mentioned, right? None of these, like, Hezbollah is hated across Lebanon, right, effectively, including by many of the Shia. And I hope I don't exaggerate it. I don't like to be naive, right? But it's clear that Hezbollah is not some very popular group in Lebanon anymore, the way that it was when it was fighting Israeli occupation, actually, in the sort of 90s. Maybe even a bit after that. But it's just not anymore, because Lebanon is effectively in a state of collapse. In Iraq, these militias have really ruined the sovereignty of the country. And some similar examples in other places. In Yemen, at best, they're part of this tapestry of civil war in that country. They really haven't provided a model that would be really attractive and that would become sort of a pole of attraction. So it could be a source of inspirations for some people, revolutionaries who are interested in this, in these groups, but really, not a sustainable source of support in any of these countries. I should also add that, as my friend Danny Twistel has argued, axis of resistance effectively plays a counter-revolutionary role, actually, not just revolutionary. By which he means that effectively it's become part of a status quo, ironically, in countries like Iraq and Lebanon, right? The axis of resistance is not part of the status quo. So it actually has to actively fight against change. So the Iraqis had a mass movement in 2019 against these conditions, as did the Lebanese. So this these so-called revolutionary forces are actually counter-revolutionary, stopping the aspirations of the people in these countries for, you know, effective national governance and a sovereign country and an opposition to the sectarian system that has really defined them.
Coming back to the issue of change or pragmatism or whatever one wants to call it, perhaps you can describe how this will manifest itself. On the one hand, domestically, you spoke a little bit about internationally, but maybe you can take that a little bit further in terms of what that would mean for Iran's relationship with the Axis of Resistance, its various non-state partners, but also in terms, for example, of the nuclear issue.
Mm-hmm. So domestic and so you mentioned domestic and international, right? Sort of the consequences of.
So, in other words, you spoke about Israel, but there are also, of course, the whole issues of indeed the relationship with Hezbollah, with the Iraqi groups, with the Houthis in Yemen, with Hamas. And there is, of course, the always lingering issue of Iran's nuclear program.
Yeah. So, and there's also a question of domestic policy. And as you want, we can talk about that. What do I mean? Yeah. Let me make a prediction, right? Again, it's sort of what I think is pragmatic sounding post-Khamenei Iran is going to do in relation to all of it. Since I wrote the op-ed, I've had interesting debates with different friends, actually, about this, right? Some of whom said, you know, they agree with me regarding the domestic policy, but maybe not so much regional policy because IRGC is sort of proud achievement, so they'll continue it. So I think, look, they're not going to immediately cut ties to all these militias because obviously, you know, well, once you have it, right, it's not a bad thing to have a few groups linked in different countries that you can use. But I think their direction is the general direction is going to be, so with the nuclear program and in regards to these militias, is to be to some, its direction is going to be coming into some sort of a regional and international agreement that can end the sanctions on Iran, end the Iranian isolation, and give a bit of a breathing space to Iran, right? The nuclear question is a bit dormant right now, actually. If you look at the last intelligence estimate that came out of the United States, they're basically saying Iran is not continuing, right? Which is interesting, right? They're not crazy, right? They know how to, pace themselves on this question. So I think they'll try to come to some sort of an agreement. Even in status quo, if they want the sanctions to be lifted, no matter who is in the White House, they'll try to do some sort of negotiations. Maybe it wouldn't be as splashy as like 2014, 2015, a nuclear deal like that. But, you know, quietly make some agreements, draw back the nuclear program enough so that these sanctions can be lifted. There will be an agreement with Saudi Arabia. So they'll come into some sort of a, you know, peace agreement, basically. And by peace, I mean, they'll basically say, look, we're not going to rock this boat too much. You know, we're not going to threaten to destroy Israel time and time again. But given, obviously, there should be a place for Hezbollah and Lebanese Shia, after all, generally, in the Lebanon structures. In Yemen, there can be a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, where there's some sort of a solution there. After all, even without the change of the Islamic Republic, there are elements of this already, right? The relationship between Iran and the militias, you know, it's interesting. Even now, the relationship of the Iran and the militias effectively is usually not the case that Tehran says, go, you know, attack all the time. In fact, it's usually the opposite, right? It's to say, you know, to basically always trying to restrain them. And now, again, we have the U.S. intelligence estimate. Thank God, you know, the United States has a system in which, you know, the intelligence sort of is not super partisan and is released in a way that there's some objectiveness to it. Because if you really read the detail, they're very clear that Iran didn't know about October 7th. Right, they didn't know about it, and it's unlikely that they would have encouraged something like this, out of the fear of getting into this conflict. So I think the important difference would be that this big, the goal of building a
powerful Iranian state that will have its own interests will take precedence over this revolutionary ideological project of building a group of militias that are, you know, sort of the militias that are leading Iran right now. And I think that will change. And I think the nature of these militias in these countries will also change. After all, one thing that is a very delicate thing for us to all remember, let's forget Palestine for a second, but in the case of Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, yes, these militias all have a revolutionary anti-Israel sort of Islamist Khomeinist ideology, but are also sectarian actors. And they get much of their sustenance in these countries as sectarian actors, right? The Lebanon, Hezbollah wouldn't exist if not for the fact that the Lebanese Shia had a history of disenfranchisement, right? And so they sometimes channeled this energy into the Communist Party before in the past, then they channeled the Amal movement, and then they end up channeling to Hezbollah. You know what I mean? So they'll always continue in some ways, but without, when the tune changes in Tehran, their tune is also going to change. And in terms of Palestine, you know, again, the real story here, of course, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, these are not Iranian groups. They have their own origins, right? They're not even Shia. They're always looking for foreign sponsors, right? The history of Palestinian militancy is that they're always looking for different foreign sponsors. It used to be Saddam or Muammar Gaddafi, Soviet Union, China at some point, and in the last few decades, it's been the Islamic Republic. So the nature of that is going to change once Iran, you know, once Iran goes on a more pragmatic route.
Would you see the fact that Iran has tried to ensure that support for Hamas and the actions of its non-state allies like Hezbollah or the Houthis in Yemen stop the, you know, the Iranian effort to make sure that it stops short of sparking a regional configuration that could involve the United States, is that an indication of the change to come that you envision? And does it suggest that there may be more common ground between technocrats, pragmatists, and hardliners?
I think it's a very good question, right? I think it shows a couple of things. First of all, it shows that even now, Iran doesn't want to get into a conflict or a war. You know, Iranians don't want to do that. Not the leadership, not the people. And they know that we can't afford it. It's not a society ready to go to a war in this condition, right? They know it would have no real support in society. So even now, that's the case. And it does show that, after all, we have to remember, my argument isn't that there are a bunch of hardliners in power now, they're going to be replaced by technocrats, right? My argument is that a lot of these so-called hardliners are actually sort of have a heavy technocratic edge. It's just that in the current conditions, the constellation of power around Khamenei is so that they play this role, right? Now, this is a bit of a risky proposition to make, and I do sort of edge this in the article by saying, you know, I don't know. It is possible that Khamenei dies. And no, these people really mean all that they say, and they're going to sort of lead a new ideological Iran, and they're not technocrats or pragmats after all. There are, you know, people like Castro Arabi, who has written on Mahdism, and they believe, oh, there's this their Mahdist millenarian ideology. No, with all due respect, I don't really buy it. I don't really think, yes, I know Said Muhammad, that I write about in some of my work, this sort of military figure. I know he talks about Mahdi all the time and the hidden imam and millenarianism. I don't think they're serious about it. Right. You know, I don't think it's true. Right. I don't think it will hold, although it's always a possibility. But yes, so the argument is that even these guys are effectively technocrats and pragmatics. And it's Khamenei who keeps the revolutionary flame alive. Right. My argument is really that, look, in 2019, in the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Khamenei gave a speech called the second phase of the revolution, right? And he basically says the second phase of the revolution is going to be built by these young revolutionaries. I basically think he has failed to build this young revolutionary, right? He has failed to build the next level leadership that could drive this revolution. And if you want to take a very broad view, you can say this is the fate of revolution, that you cannot usually build a revolution beyond a couple of generations, right? You know, that even in the Soviet Union, after a couple of generations, you know, these were apparatchiks. And after all, when communism fell, most of them very happily transitioned into becoming sort of nationalist elites in these new republics, right? And there are many other examples that you can give. So I think that the Islamic revolution is dead, you know, and that the next generation of leaders will inevitably be, you know, more pragmatic.
That takes us back to the beginning of this conversation. And, you know, the question is, what makes today's Iran different to the Iran of 1979 when the regime of the Shah was toppled by a popular revolt, or the 2011 Arab revolts that initially succeeded in overthrowing four autocrats? So why, in a sense, is it going to be that in Iran you envision a change that comes from the top rather than the result of a popular revolt?
That's a great question. I think, number one, you know, as I said, I still have hopes for popular revolts that will play a role, but I don't see that the most likely. I think the reason is in 79, you had the Shah. So what is common in 79 and 2011, frankly, the reason this dictators fall is that they're the type of people who run away, right? Shah doesn't even try when you really think about it. No, he had cancer, you know, he wasn't feeling well. If you want to be very generous to him, you can say he didn't want to kill his people, right? But Shah is not the kind of, you know, he doesn't do any real resistance, right? It's actually very striking. You think about all the options he had. And Shah, by the way, if you look at his life, he's a runner, right? This is not the first time. In 53, he runs away. Popular Zeta, 58, 59, he's basically ready to run away. He is not one who wants to stay there and defend his rule. So this is why the revolution wins in 79. This is one of the key reasons the revolution wins in 79 is the lack of resistance on the part of the Shah. I mean, 2011, it's also the case that a lot of these dictators are, after all, they've kind of run away early, right? So whether you're talking, you mentioned four, I guess, you know, you mean Hosni Mubarak and Ben Ali, they kind of resigned pretty sort of early. Ben Ali, I believe, ran to Saudi Arabia.
Indeed.
And then I guess you're talking about Saleh in Yemen and Gaddafi in Libya. Well, Gaddafi was effectively overthrown by a foreign intervention. So that was pretty different, right? That's not in the cards in Iran. And Saleh was the head of, you know, basically a civil war situation is what dislodged him from power. So none of these situations exist in Iran because there is no foreign intervention, thankfully, and there is not going to be. Unlike, and you mentioned this at the beginning, and some uninformed, malicious Israeli analysts wrote this in Jerusalem post recently, there is no, Iran is not going to split into different ethnicities. Just fervent dreams that people have are not going to happen for Iran. But Khamenei also is not going to give up power. So, you know, he's not going to give up power. So that's why I believe, that's why I believe the change is sort of the most likely rate for the change to come is from the top in this way. And what is in common with the Arab Spring, though, right? If you look at what happened in the Arab Spring, right? And Egypt is sort of a classic case, right? People come out, there's this massive rent, they bring down the government, and then it's the organized forces that run the show, right? So it's the army and the Muslim Brotherhood that duke it out over power. And, you know, and the 20 of my friends also had a third square in Tahrir Square, which is very touching, but it's not going to change things, right? So unfortunately, I see the situation the same in Iran. Like, I don't see how the Sikh movements and all that could come together to get organized in time to pose a real, to be the beneficiary of the immediate change. My hope is, though, I'm not just the analyst, right? I'm part of this as well as an Iranian activist. My hope is that we can cohere into an alternative so that we can play a role in the next phase of this fight. If one is to be more hopeful, you would think if at some point the equilibrium of different power centers in society is such that they'll allow for some sort of multi-party elections. Then a variety of Iranian progressives can continue that work, build a strong voice, you know, build their civil society, build political parties, and can sort of affect change, you know, in that way. But it's going to be a long road. It's not a short road. The idea that Iranians come and fall and the regime is replaced by a democracy and then, you know, we're all happy ever after, unfortunately, it's not in the cards. And, you know, the future of Iran is very scary to me. That's also the fact, right? There are terrible things that can happen. And that's why I think we should be smart in what we advocate for, and that we should sort of remember important values at every point. Opposition to Iran breaking up, opposition to Iran, the possibility of sort of civil conflict, opposition to all form of foreign intervention. It's very sad for me and very concerning that unfortunately figures in the Iranian opposition in the last few months, effectively, past last couple of years, have broken something that was a big taboo, and they've effectively called for the United States or Israel to attack Iran. It would not be good. It would not lead to anything good. It would not lead to any positive development from any sane view. And anyone who advocates this, you know, it's either malicious, insane, or both.
Arash, time is not our friend. Even though this has been a fascinating and enlightening conversation, I learned a lot, and I hope so has our audience. Thank you for joining me on this show, and thanks to our listeners and viewers. Please share any comments or questions you may have in the comment section of this podcast on Substack, and please stay tuned for my twice weekly episodes. Best wishes, take care, and see you soon. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed today's column and podcast. The Turbulent World with James M. Dorsey depends on the support of its readers. For the past 12 years, I have maintained free distribution as a way of maximizing impact. I am determined to keep it that way. However, to avoid putting up a paywall, I need the support of a core of voluntary paid subscribers to cover the cost of producing the column and podcast. If you believe that the column and podcast add value to your understanding and that of the broader public, please consider becoming a paid subscriber. You can do so by clicking on Substack on the subscription button at www.jamesmdorsey.substack.com and choosing one of the subscription options. Thank you, take care, and best wishes.